The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. We're on today's show. We're going to tackle something that came in from a listener. They sent us an email about the death of the Stretch IRA and what planning opportunities might exist around that. So we thought we would tackle that today, something we haven't talked about for a little bit. There's been a lot of, brain power, if you will, in the industry put forth to try to come up with planning opportunities now that the Stretch IRA, the traditional Stretch IRA we've dealt with for several decades, it's at least 20 years, has gone away and been replaced by new rules in practically all accounts. So I've got Jim on the phone here down in his office. So he's got the email so he can share some of the details of what this particular listener was curious about. But we'll talk a bit about that death of the Stretch and planning opportunities today.
Perfect. And how are you doing today, Chris?
Pretty well. I'm a little got a little bit of cabin fever. It's beautiful outside and I'm stuck inside. But other than that, things are glorious.
Did you get out over the weekend?
I did. It's this weekend wasn't as nice as it is right now, though. So that's the rough part. And it gets even nicer as the week progresses. So I think it's supposed to be almost 80 degrees on Thursday.
Yeah, it's going to actually above 80. They said it may be mid-80s Thursday and Friday.
Oh, my goodness.
The 2 days that I will be attending the Ed Slott convention, I was supposed to be in Baltimore. Beginning on Wednesday, I was going to be flying out, and then I was going to spend Thursday, Friday, Saturday studying with Ed and his group, and then I was going to fly to Boston on Saturday and spend a week with family. But all that got ixnayed with the coronavirus. My mom is still in Florida. She's too nervous to leave Florida and head back to Massachusetts. So, and then, of course, Ed canceled his event, and I have to sit in my house kind of on house arrest, if you will, and do Zoom meetings all day Thursday and Friday. And because Ed is based in New York and we're mountain time, and Ed starts at 9 in the morning, I'll be starting at 7 in the morning, but fortunately getting out at 3 in the afternoon instead of 5.
Well, 3 here, right?
Yeah, 3 here. It would be 5 o'clock for Ed, but he gets to start at 9. I get to start at 7.
Oh,
anyway, so we'll be doing that. I'm not a huge fan of day-long Zoom meetings, so we'll see how that goes. But that's what I'll be doing Thursday and Friday of this week when it is supposed to be about 85 here. Way too soon for weather this hot, that I'll say.
Yeah, it's this is supposed to be perfect weather for cool vegetable planting and stuff here shortly, and if it's going to be that hot, that's not good.
No, it's supposed to be nice and cool in the early spring, not mid-80s. So I'm not really looking forward to Thursday and Friday, but it is what it is. Okay, speaking of hot, we got an email from Louisiana, and I thought this email could become a good EDU show. And I thought I would run with it as an EDU show because he asks some questions on the death of the Stretch. And coronavirus kind of has taken the thunder out of a massive new bill, the SECURE Act, which was really the talk of the town, if you will, until, at least in financial planning, it was the talk of the town until coronavirus. And now the SECURE Act has kind of taken a back seat to the CARES Act and the trillions of dollars that the government is throwing at this coronavirus issue. So you don't hear much about the SECURE Act anymore. But this gentleman laid out a very lengthy email, I'll tell you that much. And he concedes his situation may not perfectly represent every single listener we have to this podcast, but he felt, as and I share in his sentiment, that the basics of his case could apply to a lot of people. Maybe not the dollar amounts, Chris, but the strategies and the basics of his situation could apply to a lot of people. And he was wondering if we would entertain this as an EDU show. And because it differed from the CARES Act and all this coronavirus hubbub that keeps going on, I thought this would be a good divergence. And let's answer this. So does that sound fair and reasonable?
Yeah, perfect.
All righty. So let's begin. I'll probably try to breeze through some of this email. It's a very, very long email. But I do want to capture enough of his situation to really relay it well to our listeners. So it begins, "Dear Jim and Chris, first off, I want to compliment your show and let you know how much I enjoy it. It has become my favorite podcast, as it seems to be the only one out there for more sophisticated do-it-yourselfers like me." Wow, we're sophisticated. Well, he's sophisticated.
Yeah, he is, not us.
Thought he was giving us a compliment there. He's the sophisticated
yeah,
one. All
exactly.
Right. Okay. "Also, I like the way that you not only focus on retirement strategies to spend deferred income and minimize taxes." And when he said that, it made me realize, Chris, he does listen to our podcast, because he put deferred income in quotation marks. Listen to what he said there, listeners. I'll read it again. "Also, I like the way that you not only focus on retirement strategies to spend deferred income and minimize taxes. Chris and I often encourage you to start thinking of your assets, your savings, the money you are amassing, as what it is. It is deferred income. In fact, I've challenged..."
Well, what we talk about is deferred spending. He called spending deferred income. We've shortened it
True.
And just call it deferred spending.
Deferred
yeah.
spending. Yeah. True. "Okay, but that's what Chris and I want you to think of. It is deferred spending, or as he has worded it, deferred income. It is money that is meant to be spent." So he continues, "Rather than focusing on just accumulating assets, which seems to be an abundance of podcast sources for this information." So that is something Chris and I have done, goodness, now for years. I can't remember how many years we've been doing this, either as a podcast or a radio show, Chris, but I would say over 12. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think June here in the next couple months is our 12th anniversary of doing this, yeah.
Okay. Not necessarily as a podcast, folks, but it started originally as a dedicated radio show in Northern Colorado. But we said to the radio station when we were first chatting with them about bringing a show onto their platform that it would not be a stock jock show. We're not going to get into talking about what stocks to buy, what hot investment to buy, what things to do. And I remember the radio show person was wondering how long could we talk about retirement. Do you remember that? And he
yeah.
asked us, "So what are you thinking, 6 months or a year? How long before you run out of things to say?" And 12 years later, we're still going strong. So I guess we haven't ran out of things to say. "Finally, I think that your approach to retirement planning is eschewing, right?
I'm not reading it, but it sounds like it.
Okay. Eschewing, which means put aside in case I'm not pronouncing that right. Eschewing Monte Carlo-based predictive models in favor of guaranteed income to ensure a minimum dignity floor while isolating your fund money and simplification for those older years when your financial aptitude is beginning to decline should be the industry standard." So he really butted up to us in that first
yeah.
paragraph. So I do like that, and I appreciate that. And that's why I wanted to read that first paragraph. I do appreciate that listener and all listeners who seem to get the approach that Chris and I are trying to do. Retirement planning is not about accumulating assets. It's about spending what you've amassed. That's why we call it deferred spending, or he calls it deferred income. But it is money that is meant to be consumed. Retirement is the opposite. We did a whole show on the opposite once. We played snippets from Seinfeld on that show, where they had the opposite episode. And what we try to get people to understand is the rules that took you to retirement are not the rules that will take you through retirement. So we do believe in that, and we appreciate people who pick up on what we're trying to do. All right, now he gets into the nitty-gritty. I have a question as to whether or not it makes sense to continue contributing to my company's cash balance retirement plan in light of the elimination of the stretch IRA following the passage of the SECURE Act. Let me give you some background. I am 51 years old, single, with two teenagers. Currently, and he's divorced, folks. Later on, he does explain that in his email, but he is divorced. Currently, despite this coronavirus correction, I remain in pretty good shape for retirement. I have roughly $5 million in maybe taxable accounts, $100,000 in a never taxable Roth IRA, $250,000 in a never taxable Roth 401k, and $900,000 in an always taxable company-sponsored 401k. In addition, I have $150,000 in my aforementioned cash balance retirement plan. So right off the bat, Chris, without breaking out your calculator there, I'm sure you picked up on what I picked up on. The vast majority of his money, $5 million, is in maybe taxable accounts.
Yeah, I didn't add it up as you went by, but that sounds about right.
Right. And he's got about $350,000 in Roth, what we call never taxable, if he takes the money out correctly, never taxable Roth accounts, and about $900,000. I'm going to make it actually $1 million, $900,000 in a company 401k and $150,000 in a cash balance retirement plan, which he will be able to take out as a lump sum and move it into an IRA. So between the two of those, he has about $1 million in always taxable accounts, $5 million in what we call maybe taxable accounts. In other words, he may pay taxes on money coming from that account. He may not. Lots going to depend on tax rules and situations at the time. And again, about $350,000 in never taxable accounts. So he does have some tax diversification. But I like the fact that his largest holding, I mean, it would be better if it was in a Roth, but at least it's in a maybe taxable account and not an always taxable account, because he's worried about the death of the stretch IRA. Okay, any thoughts or feedback so far on anything that I read, Chris?
No, he has what I would call, compared to a lot of people these days, a fairly atypical mix of always taxable, never taxable, and maybe taxable. He's much heavier on the maybe taxable than a typical 50 or 60 year old these days, because most people in that age bracket have been trained over the years or have been working in jobs where they shoved a ton of money away into deferred accounts, tax deferred accounts like a 401k or an IRA, where they've got, at this point, as their 50s and 60s, the vast majority in always taxable accounts. So he's a little unique in that as far as the type of folks that we usually interact with.
Exactly. And I'd rather he have that money in a maybe taxable account than a always taxable account, because he's worried about the death of the stretch, and he'll walk you through why he's worried about that in a second. And if he had $5 million in his always taxable account instead of $1 million in the always taxable account, his fear of the death of the stretch, I think, would be even greater than what it is.
Yeah. One thing I do want to point out before you go on, us talking about liking that he has it in the maybe taxable, that is not a comment on, boy, it's a good idea when he was 20 for him not to participate in his tax-deferred accounts like a 401k and instead pile all his money up in a brokerage account. That is not necessarily what we are saying by any means. But he's coming to us water under the bridge. That's what he has now. So now going forward, what I'm saying is he may have paid a tax penalty in the past for what he's done. Moving forward, though, he's maybe in a better tax position than most because he has a bunch of money in maybe taxable. But don't forget, it's probably because he overpaid taxes in the past. Well, I won't say probably. It might be due to him overpaying taxes in the past. So I just want to make that. I don't want people to interpret our positive comments about maybe taxable into that's how a 25 or 30-year-old should approach saving for retirement.
Perfect. Okay. So he continues. He continues. Where did I leave off? This is a long email, and I just lost my place in it. My plans are tax efficient with my always taxable holdings of the bond. So, in other words, he's laying out how he's allocating his assets, and I really don't need to get into that part. Actually, come to think of this, because it's a long section. So, let me try to get into the nitty gritty. Okay, I am an owner/partner. I max out the employer-employee 401k contributions of $56,000 per year. I contribute an additional $10,000 to a solo 401k representing consulting work I do on the side. And I am in the second year of a 5-year pay-in to my cash balance retirement plan, of which I will contribute $140,000. Now, I don't know if that's – I believe that's per year he contributes that. I anticipate another 5 years of these contributions into the cash balance plan, so it's $140,000 a year, to be established – I anticipate at the end of this 5-year period, another 5-year cash balance plan will be established. At that time, I would have the option of contributing even more to it, as I will now be 4 years older. I estimate a 3% annual rate of return in my 401ks and cash balance plan. He's being very conservative on his rate of return. I like that, Chris. The cash balance plan, again, is keying off of his age. The cash balance plan is kind of a, I don't want to get too deep into that, but a hybrid between a defined contribution plan and a defined benefit plan. So he's contributing to it based on his age. He's putting in $140,000, and then in 4 more years, when this 5-year plan is over, he has the option, Chris, of renewing for another 5 years of payments into his cash balance pension plan. Follow me along so far with that?
I do.
Okay. In addition, I have a whole life policy from New York Life, and I was pleased to read a highly rated insurance company, he said, from New York Life, which will be fully paid up when I am 59 with a $1 million guaranteed death benefit and a current $260,000 cash value. When I read that part of his email, I thought to myself, this guy had to have bought this policy somewhere in his mid-30s, early 40s. And he bought one with most likely a 20 to 25-year payment period on the premiums, and that he was earmarking the $1 million death benefit as a guaranteed inheritance, maybe to pay estate taxes or something. These are the thoughts running through my head when I got to that part of his email. So as I continue on, he delves into that. He says, my purpose of the policy was to have a permanent death benefit to cover estate taxes, which is what I figured. Remember, folks, when he bought this, well, let me continue on. I'll spill the beans. This policy was purchased when I was 38 years old, and my financial future was less certain than it is today, and my children were very young. Remember, folks, when he bought this policy, estate taxes, Chris, were a lot higher than they are today. Not only the tax rates, but the taxable amount of your estate, remember? Because this is going back about 14 years ago.
Right, so he could have been back when it was $1 million, right, the estate tax limit at that point. It's close to that time period, actually.
Yeah, we'd have to back this up and look at the history of the law. But remember, it was 600 something thousand for a long time.
Right.
Then they raised it to $1 million. Then they raised it to $3 million. And then Bush got rid of it for 1 year. And I mean, they've been playing with the estate tax so much over the past 20 years. But when he put this together and bought that $1 million policy, what he was thinking was, I want this policy fully paid off by time I retire. It's paid off when he's 59 years old. We'll call it 60. So it was designed to be paid off fully, but he also anticipated, Chris, he bought it when he was 38, but he anticipated a degree of success was going to come in his life, and he felt estate taxes were going to be an issue. Not to mention, he had very young kids at the time, and if he died beforehand, he wanted the money most likely to be inherited by his then spouse to probably be used to help take care of her and raise the kids. So I think that policy definitely had a time and a place and fit in. And I think it was a wise choice. You often see whole life policies. You'll know I'm not a huge fan of whole life policies. They do have a lot of fees in them. The insurance companies that offer whole life, which are generally mutual insurance companies, but not all of them, kind of downplay the cost of whole life policies. But they are relatively expensive. But they're stodgy. They're old school type policies. They're very, from a highly rated carrier, and he has his with a very highly rated carrier, New York Life. It's just a very stodgy, old, sure thing. You know what I mean, Chris? It's going to be there.
Yeah, and what he said about it, though, he bought it for reasons that are somewhat compelling for that purpose. He didn't say, oh, somebody talked me into buying it to help my retirement. That's when we really cringe. That's when
right.
The hair on the back of my neck stands up.
That was the call we had not too long ago with an index universal life, a different type of permanent policy, where it was being sold as a way to supplement retirement as opposed to being sold to a very successful young person on his way to peak earnings and to amassing wealth and trying to design, I'm guessing, the policy to be fully paid up by time he retires, to provide liquidity to his estate to help pay estate taxes, because he was probably doing calculations. And had they not changed the estate tax rules, Chris, this man would definitely be subject to estate taxes right now.
Right.
So, again, I have no problem with this policy, what it was sold for. A whole life policy. Now, agents that don't represent whole life companies, that represent more universal type companies, those are generally publicly traded companies, although not all the time. They may have bashed whole life as being stodgy and old school and expensive, but it's doing what it was meant to do, and it's to be fully paid for, he said, by age 59. What I would encourage him to do, same thing that we told a recent listener on the Q&A show, get in-force illustrations to make sure the participating dividends being paid into that policy have not been cut since you were 38. They are being projected to go forward as illustrated, and the policy will be fully funded for the length of time that you hope it will be fully funded for. And I would be curious to see how long this policy is going to last. Is it going to last till age 100, or is it going to last past that? You may want to look at some of these things just to make sure the policy is performing as you hope. But I have no problem with this, and I'm not going after it. And at this point, Chris, he's had this policy since 38. He's 51 now. So what's that? 12 years? 13 years, that he's had this policy. Most of the fees of a whole life policy are paid for in the first 10 years. Mm-hmm. So he spent most of the fees. To get rid of the policy now would be questionable. You paid all these high fees for what? Now the policy is going to start performing even better. And just remember, with the whole life listener, your cash value is eventually going to grow to levels that essentially equal the death benefit. So the risk to New York Life, unique with the whole life policies, does what, Chris? Every year gets less and less and less because the cash value gets
goes down as long as that cash value amount is growing. And that's usually, you know, a participating plan, most likely like that, is going to get those dividends. That's going to what's going to ultimately feed this. So later in life, in his 90s or 100, New York Life is just holding the money really at that point, and it's just a tax vehicle for estate planning purposes or death benefit.
Okay. Unknown to me at the time I bought this policy was that there would be a family business and vacation property issues and real estate taxes to deal with upon my death. So again, I have no problem with that particular policy.
Those
I wanted
more
to make
reasons
mention
to keep
of
it.
That.
Yeah.
True, exactly. And because he's paid most of the fees into it already, whole life doesn't work too well for older people, in my opinion. Now, I know a whole life agent is going to be screaming at me over that, because if you were trying to buy a whole life policy at age 60, it's going to be tremendously expensive. And most of the first 5-10 years of that policy are going to be nothing but fees. But buying it at 38, when he's younger and probably had the free cash flow, I have no problem with it. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. He already talked about that. My plan was to retire at age 60. And that's why I think the policy is paid up at 60. My plan was to retire at 60 and begin spending. Now, before you chime in, Chris, let me read what he says, because he talks about this in the past as his plan. It's not what he's going to do now, thankfully. My plan was to retire at 60. Not that we have anything wrong with him retiring at 60, is what he wrote next. And it was to live off of my sometimes taxable money and the qualified dividends they generate, and begin trying to convert some of my assets to Roth IRAs in an effort to reduce required minimum distributions, particularly when those RMDs get combined with my Social Security. At my current rate of contributions and my predicted conservative 3% average annual rate of return, he wrote 3.5 here, but didn't he say 3 earlier? I estimate a 3% annual rate of return. So I'm not sure if he's estimating a 3 or a 3.5, because down here he references 3.5. Irrespective, I think his rate of return assumption, Chris, is very reasonable. Do you?
Absolutely.
I mean, he's not sitting there saying at a 10% rate of return.
Yeah, no, that would be below average for what people are usually forecasting heading into retirement.
I anticipate my maybe taxable account will grow to $10 million. My always taxable will be worth a little more than $3 million, and that includes, I believe, the money that he'll be contributing to his cash balance plan. And my Roth account will be worth about $550,000. So I took that, Chris, and I broke it down, and that comes to about 75% always taxable at age 60, 22%
maybe
taxable, and 3% never. Or did I say that wrong? 75% maybe, 22% always, and 3% never.
Yep.
Okay, I muffed that one up. So, again, I don't see anything wrong right now, folks, with his projections. He's looking through, factoring in a very reasonable 3.5% or so percent rate of return assumption, factoring in the savings that he's doing into his cash balance plan, and he has such a tremendous head start in his maybe taxable accounts, Chris, with $5 million already, that that's just going to keep growing. And I'm guessing through his income, everything that's not being plowed into these retirement accounts is being plowed into the maybe taxable account. He doesn't say that, but to go from $5 million to $10 million in 9 years at 3.5% rate of return, that's not going to double in 9 years. Right. So it has to be that he has extra monies, because he does allude in his next couple of paragraphs that he's in the top income tax bracket, as you can pretty much surmise. Mm-hmm. And as a single person, he's got to be making, what, north of $500,000 a year, isn't it?
Well, I haven't looked at the single brackets for so long.
Because you're married.
Because I'm married. Yeah, exactly. Oh, you probably look at him all the time.
You implying something about me not being married?
Just that you are looking at different tax brackets.
Well, why don't you see how much he can be earning? Because he is definitely, he indicates in the highest bracket. Yeah.
Okay, if he's in the top bracket, loading. There we go. Top bracket is 518, so you were pretty darn close.
Okay. All right. With the expectation that significant assets would be left to my children, my original thought was to establish stretch IRAs for them, taking advantage of the expected lower marginal brackets they will be in, combined with the non-taxable Roth IRAs that I would have created through 10 years of conversions, along with whatever was left over in my maybe taxable accounts and my $1 million in life insurance, all held together with trusts. So what he's saying he did do, Chris, listeners and Chris, if I understand that paragraph correctly, he created trusts where he thought his always taxable IRA would lock in the stretch to his kids. So I'm guessing he created what was then called a conduit trust. Because remember, listeners, we talked about this on our podcast many times, and it was perfect and still is perfectly legal to name a trust as beneficiary of an IRA. Now, we didn't like it if you were trying to protect and control those IRA assets, not pass them out to your kids, whether it be because your kids have special needs and you didn't want the money to pass out to them, or they had maybe married a spouse you didn't care for and you didn't want that spouse to inherit anything, or they had creditor issues or drug issues. For a variety of reasons, you didn't want, Chris, the money to go to the kids. He never talks about that. He says, my plan was always to spread out my money in my IRA and leave it to my kids, either by converting it during my life and leaving it to them in a Roth, or locking in the stretch through a trust and allowing them to spread it out over their lower tax brackets. So he didn't assume his children would succeed, I guess, and be in as high a bracket as he was. Maybe I'm reading a little too much into that aspect, I don't know. But he thought he was going to lock in the stretch and allow his IRA to be drained at their lower marginal brackets.
Right.
And you could do that before the passage of the Secure Act because you would create what is called a conduit trust, which would allow, if done correctly, and I'm not going to get into how to do it correctly because it's a moot point, but if done correctly, he doesn't say, I think he said he had two kids, but I could be wrong on that. But if it was two children, each child would have their own sub-trust, if you will. And it would be set up, folks, where the RMDs, based on that child's life expectancy, would be the only thing that would leave the IRA, enter the conduit trust, and like a conduit, pass right through. And that conduit had a one-way valve on the end of it, is the way I used to describe it. And when the RMD passed through, that one-way valve shut, Chris, and the kid couldn't get back into the IRA, could they?
Right. I gave you the somewhat control, but still allowed it to flow through to for some tax benefits, but it didn't allow to the rest of it to be jeopardized by someone swimming upstream to grab the rest.
Right. So in essence, his ideas would work perfect because, folks, you might be saying, oh, but all that money wouldn't be available to the kids in a lump sum if they needed it. That was his plan, folks. Remember, he was estimating he was going to have $10 million in maybe taxable accounts, $500,000 in never taxable accounts. He was going to try to increase the never taxable accounts through select Roth conversions for the first 10 years of his retirement and maybe grow that a little bit, but just protect the stretch out to his children. And the kids could inherit via a trust, Chris, the $1 million of life insurance, the $10 million of never taxable money, which may or may not have received a step up in basis and be received by the trust tax-free. The life insurance would have been received tax-free, and the Roth would have been received also tax-free. So the trust, which would have been available to the children immediate for lump sum needs, would have been fully protected in the trust from creditors and predators and bankruptcy, but would have been received tax-free, whereas the IRA would be doling out a little bit every year as a guaranteed stretch to the kids. Mm-hmm. You see how he had that planned out?
Mm-hmm. I did. A lot of people had something similar, even if they didn't have quite the dollar amounts that we're talking about here, but that was a fairly typical approach when people anticipated having quite a lot that was going to be left over when they passed, and they wanted to exert some kind of some control, and they were putting some tax planning into their strategy.
Exactly. And this can apply to many people. As he said, maybe the dollar amounts will be different, but a lot of people were looking at strategies like this. And trusts, conduit trusts, were commonly used to guarantee the stretch. People would say, what can I do to make sure my kids don't blow this IRA? And I just want them to keep it open over their lifetime like the law allows. A conduit trust would do that. The one-way valve would keep the kids from going back through the trust into the IRA and grabbing the money, but every year, based on the beneficiary's life expectancy, a little bit of the IRA would pass out. It would leave the IRA, go into the trust, avoid the compressed and very high trust tax rates, because like a conduit, a one-way valve, it would immediately pass to the kids, Chris, and the kids could spend it and pay taxes at their lower rates. So that's how he had it set up. So he continues. However, with the passage of the Secure Act and now the death of the stretch, I'm concerned that my inherited IRAs and cash balance plan, which I would combine into one IRA, so he was looking to simplify things, I have no problem with that, will be subject to very high tax rates, particularly if I held them in a trust which would not pass out the money quickly to my children. So in other words, if he didn't have a conduit trust, Chris, but if he had it set up as an accumulation trust. Because what happens now, Chris, with the Secure Act and the death of the stretch?
Well, it all has to be liquidated within by the end of 10 years. So the trust is going to have to recognize that. If it holds any of that in there, it's going to be recognized inside the trust at trust tax rates, which he was trying to avoid exposing those dollars, those that deferred income, to his highest tax bracket. But lo and behold, in the trust, it'll be exposed to the highest tax bracket, the vast majority of it, because it's being flushed out of there within that 10-year period, and he's going to blow way past the trust tax bracket that puts you in the highest tax rate, which it occurs at like $15,000 or so.
$12,750.
Yeah, so it's worse than what 15, yeah.
So what Chris said in English, if the, and you might be wondering how, what Chris meant was how Chris could say it's going to be highly taxed when I just said his Roth assets, life insurance assets, and maybe taxable bank and brokerage assets would be received by the trust tax-free. Do not confuse, folks. The money inside your IRA or 401k or cash balance plan, if he didn't take it out of the cash balance plan and put it in an IRA, do not confuse those assets, folks, with his bank and brokerage assets and Roth assets. Even if they were all invested in the same place, let's pretend this guy is another Vanguardian, which 90% of our podcast listeners are with Vanguard. Let's say he had all his money at Vanguard, Chris. They all look at the same. Wow, I've got IRAs at Vanguard. I have my cash balance plan, which I moved to an IRA at Vanguard. I got my Roth at Vanguard. I got my brokerage money at Vanguard. I'm all at Vanguard. And you see all this Vanguard stuff. The IRS doesn't see that, folks. The IRS sees the money inside his IRA. They don't give a darn that it's at Vanguard. They see the money inside his IRA as IRD, income with respect to a decedent. You see assets, listeners, whether they're all at Vanguard or not, the IRS sees income. And maybe that's why he referenced deferred income. The IRS sees income inside his IRA. They see assets inside his bank and brokerage accounts. They see nothing inside the Roth. The Roth, to them, it's dead money as far as they're concerned. If taken out correctly, it's never going to be subject to taxes. You see assets, listeners. You see all these accounts held at Vanguard, even if they're invested in the exact same Vanguard accounts. The fact of the matter is, the IRS views his Roth, his maybe taxable bank and brokerage accounts, his life insurance, and his IRA assets, which contain his 401k and his cash balance plan that he combined into an IRA, they see that IRA dramatically different. And because it's viewed as income, trusts will pay the highest income tax bracket, not at $518,000 for a single person, but after receiving $12,000, I think it's for 2020, $12,750. It changes every year by a little bit. After receiving just $12,750, every dollar above that received by a trust and not passed through to a beneficiary but held in a trust will be taxed at the highest income tax rate then in existence. So if he died in 20 years when the highest marginal rate is 50%, half of that money would be lost if held in the trust. Not a very good thing. So he recognizes that, and he's saying, geez, with the passage of the Secure Act, if I didn't want to pass all this money on to my kids, I would have to hold it inside a trust as an accumulation, Chris, and it's going to get nailed in taxes. Conversely, his current strategy of a conduit trust, folks, that passes the required minimum distribution every year also on to his kids isn't going to work. And the reason is, kids, not kids, well, if his kids are listening, the reason is, kids and listeners, there are no more RMDs with the passage of the Secure Act when inherited by a non-spouse beneficiary. The only RMD is what, Chris? There's only one.
10 years.
Exactly. So from year 1 through 9, no money comes out of the IRA.
Well, it could, but it doesn't have to.
Well, the problem with a lot of conduit trusts is the language.
Oh, right. It's tied to the RMD requirement.
Correct. Mm-hmm. A lot of the language says the required minimum distributions, or minimum required distributions is the way the IRS calls them, the required minimum distributions will be taken every year from the IRA. I'm saying it in English. It's written in a lot more legalese. Will be taken from the IRA and passed through to the beneficiary. Well, there are no RMDs anymore. There's only one. one big ass one in year 10. And that's the entire IRA. Comes out, goes into the conduit trust, and then what happens to it, Chris? Passed right to the kid.
Yep. Yep.
And he was looking to stretch that part of his inheritance out. If he took the IRA, folks, and mixed it with his other trust, I hope he doesn't have one trust for all of this. If he was to mix it with his other trust that is receiving his life insurance, which is a discretionary trust, it's not passing it off to the kids, but life insurance is received by the trust, what, Chris? Tax-free.
Tax-free. Income tax-free. Yep.
Income tax, not estate tax. Very good. Thank you for pointing that out. Income tax free. The discretionary trust can receive it. His maybe taxable assets, hopefully, step up in basis. We've talked about this recently on podcasts. Politicians are coming after the step up in basis next. But right now, step up in basis is still the law of the land. If he passed away with $10 million in maybe taxable assets, how much in income taxes does the trust pay on that $10 million when it receives it?
Zero.
Zero if they sold it exactly for what they inherited it with on the day he died.
Right.
If it was worth $10 million and they received it and they sold it for exactly $10 million, no taxes. If he died when it was worth $10 million and they sold it when it was worth $11 million, they being the trust, sold it when it was worth $11 million, there would be $1 million in taxes. But it wouldn't be all income taxes. It would be a mixture of cap gains and who knows what else. Because of the step up in basis, folks. And the Roth would sit there for 9 years and 364 days. Assuming he died on January 1st. And on December 31st of the year, 10 years after he died, it would pay out everything in one lump sum tax-free to the trust. Income tax-free. So a discretionary trust can easily receive those assets, life insurance, maybe taxable assets, and Roth assets. But IRA assets, which he anticipates would be about $3 million, $3 million of IRA assets, if that paid into the discretionary trust and the discretionary trust didn't want to pass on $3 million to the kids, they'd pay taxes, income taxes, on the difference, and I can't do that math in my head. Do you know what $3 million minus $12,750 is?
It's pretty much all $3 million. Let's just say that.
$2,987,250. Yeah. Thank God for my HP12C.
Yeah.
Would be taxed to the trust at what, Chris? The highest marginal tax rate in existence at his death. What if that is 50%? What if we're back to those levels because this country is in debt up to their frickin' eyeballs and getting worse with this coronavirus?
Well, even now with the top bracket at 37, then you can have some state taxes in there. You're approaching the 50% now in certain jurisdictions, certain
areas. Oh, yeah.
If
you're in New
right
York
now.
Or California, mm-hmm. He's in Louisiana. I don't know what taxes are down there. But, yeah, if you are in San Francisco area of California or New York City, yeah, you can kiss half your portfolio goodbye or half of that near $3 million already goodbye. So he recognizes his current estate plan ain't going to work. And the trust that is receiving his life insurance, his Roth, and his maybe taxable assets isn't going to work. And keep your eye, folks and listener, on the rules. That maybe taxable $10 million may not be maybe taxable at death. If they, some politicians have their choice come true. So he begins, my question is, with the death of the stretch and it no longer being feasible, would I be better off try to limit even further the growth of my always taxable accounts by eliminating my cash balance pension plan after the 5-year period rather than extending it for an additional 5 years? Also, would I be better off drawing down my always taxable money early in retirement in an effort to leave an even larger amount of sometimes taxable accounts, which can be left to my trust for my kids tax-free because of the favorable step-up in basis. I've got an issue with your reliance on a current tax rule that previous administrations, the Obama administration, and even Biden, who's running now, have specifically pointed out is the biggest loophole in the tax code. That's how they're describing it. That's how Obama at least described it. They're going to come after the step-up in basis, folks. Chris and I talked about why they had that rule. It was nearly impossible for years to track basis. It's not impossible anymore. And I think they're going, maybe not tomorrow or next week or next year, but do you agree, Chris, with this assumption that I'm making that someday step up in basis will go the way of the dodo bird?
I think it is because it's a way to collect additional taxes without appearing to raise tax rates or increase taxes on people. It's one of these where you take away some tax advantage and they hope that that isn't interpreted by the mass population as a tax increase. You know, people paying attention know that's exactly what it is. But, you know, I think it's an easier one than some of the other proposals to raise more tax revenue. This is going to be an easier one for them to pass without as much resistance. There'll be resistance, but every, you know, no one's going really raising their hand and saying, please tax me more. Some people, I guess, publicly announce that they're so rich and say, please take more of my money in taxes. But there's not many regular folks out there who are saying, please tax me more. So they're always going to get some kind of resistance. It's just a matter of the path of least resistance. And I think this is one of them, kind of like causing Social Security to become taxable, become exposed to taxation. That was easier than raising taxes another way. So there's all kinds of things we see now. It's just a way for them to do it less offensively to people, I guess.
Right. Well, the death of the stretch was a revenue raiser. And
Absolutely.
At least the Senate admitted that.
Yeah.
And we had been saying for years, they're going to get rid of the stretch IRA. Just stop planning for it. They're getting rid of the stretch IRA. And they did. I thought they'd go back to the old rule, which was 5 years. And I'm still not convinced a future Congress, 5, 10, 15 years from now, doesn't make the 10-year stretch go to 5 years. Because that's what it always was. And they can fall back on that. Well, that's the way it was always. This 10-year rule, well, that's stupid. Let's go back to the way it always was, 5 years. But keep in mind, listener and listeners, on a maybe taxable account, even if they get rid of the step-up in basis, your original basis, he doesn't say how much of that $5 million is basis, Chris, will not be subject to taxes even when it goes into the trust. So out of that $5 million, $3 million of it is his contributions, is only $2 million of growth, it would only be $2 million that's taxed when it goes into the trust. If it was worth $10 million and $6 million was basis, then only $4 million would be subject to taxes. So do keep that in mind, that maybe taxable assets aren't fully taxable unless your basis was outrageously low. Okay. So far he's on track with things, but I am hesitant with his over-reliance on the step-up in basis being there. That's what I wanted to share with him and with all listeners. If I withdraw my always taxable assets early in retirement and combine them with Roth conversions, those conversions, though, will surely be at the highest marginal tax bracket, potentially even higher than my current bracket, although I will be retiring to an income tax-free state. So he's in Louisiana. I don't know if he's just going to head a little bit to the left and go into Florida, where you can't tell the difference between the humidity anyways, and have a tax-free state. So he's going to save a little bit on income taxes. But, he continues, would establishing and contributing to another Roth 401k be advisable for me now? Again, I'll be making them at the highest income tax brackets. Should I take advantage of the CARE Act and allow me to remove penalty-free a 2020 Roth conversion of $100,000 even though it will be taxed at my highest marginal rate. Okay, listener, I'm not going to go down into that rabbit hole, but it doesn't work that way. And Chris and I have explained to everyone the ability to withdraw $100,000, you have to make sure you qualify for a COVID-related issue. You haven't said anything in your email to me that you had suffered a loss due to COVID. But assuming you could qualify, you can't just take the $100,000 out and put it into a Roth and spread the taxes out over 3 years. We've been talking about that. There's no guidance yet from the IRS. And as we've said on this podcast from Ed Slott himself, there's nothing in the law that says you can't do that. But on the other hand, Chris, there's nothing in the law that what?
Explicitly says you can.
Exactly.
And it's not really with the intent
spirit
of the
law.
The spirit of the law was not consistent with what you're describing. Now, he didn't say that. He definitely could do a conversion. There's no such thing as a penalty on the conversion. He can do that at any time.
I wanted to point that out to him, too.
Yeah,
The CARES Act is a moot point when you're doing a conversion. There is no 10% penalty because you're 51. Right. So
even if you weren't 51, you could do a conversion.
Right, but he was thinking because he's only 51, there's going to be a 10% penalty on a conversion. That doesn't apply.
Right.
So I don't like that whole part of your email, listener, and I would get off that coronavirus withdrawal. Let's try to make a conversion unless the IRS explicitly comes out sometime this year and sanctions that. Hey, if you qualify for a coronavirus withdrawal and you withdraw the $100,000 and put it into a Roth IRA in 2020 immediately, you can still spread the taxes out over 3 years. We have no problem with that. Then my answer of ignore that goes away, and you might definitely want to consider that.
Well, if he's in the top tax bracket, it's not really going to make a difference whether he does it all this year or in the future.
True.
So. It may not be worth doing it anyway, but...
True.
But,
moot point, but he's trying to get his money out of the IRA.
Right, totally.
And he's wondering, let's get to the meat and potato of what he's asking. Don't lose sight of that.
Yep.
Should he stop in 4 more years? He has to contribute to the cash balance plan for 5 years. And then he was going to do it for another 5 years. Remember, he's putting $140,000 a year into it. Should he stop doing that and not keep growing his always taxable account, because he's going to lose the stretch, which is what he wanted. He wanted that stretch. I have a problem with that, Chris, because he's getting such a benefit from it right now, being in the highest marginal bracket, and he's getting a good deduction. Now, I don't know in the future. He's going to retire to an income tax-free state. I don't know what his future income is going to be, but if he's going to have a $3 million IRA, that's what he estimated he's going to have at age 60, and he's estimating a 3% growth rate on his IRA. So if it grew from $3 million at 3.5% for another 12 years... That gives him a future value of what? I got to get my I got to fire this thing up. I should have remembered that. 12 years, 3%, nothing else going in. He'll have about $4.2 million, giving him his first RMD of about $158,000. Still no way near, Chris, the top marginal bracket.
And that's what I was going to say. This whole time he's worried the amount in his always taxable account isn't excessive. I mean, it's large, but it's not beyond excessive, creating nightmarish RMDs. Plus, he's got from 60 to 72 to put a dent in that through some strategies. Now, he might also be thinking, yeah, I'm going to have all this other income coming in from my maybe taxable account. Well, there's different ways to allocate that account that may be more tax efficient than others, and with some tax planning around all of those things. And that's, I was going to say, I've got the answer to his question, should he do it? the answer is maybe, and it's maybe because you've got to look at a few of the key variables. And one you pointed out, what are the RMDs really going to be? What kind of tax situation are you going to be in? What opportunity do you have between retirement and 72 to make distributions and or conversions at better rates than you're doing now? You know, right now, you're absolutely right. All those deferrals that he puts in, he's deferring income at the highest bracket, which is where it's most attractive for most people. The chance he's also going to be in that very highest bracket for the entirety of his retirement, I don't think is true. I don't think that's going to happen given what he's describing to us. I think he is absolutely going to have the chance to access that money one way or another, get that money out of the always taxable at better rates than he's got right now. But we don't have all the exact numbers in his whole situation to say that for sure. I'm just suspecting that's the case, and he needs to look at the specifics and do a decent forecast, whether it's in Excel, basically, or something more sophisticated than that, somebody maybe that can help you run some of these projections, and look at different scenarios, and then you will find your answer. You'll find the most likely approach that will benefit you, given the fact that you can't rely on that stretch anymore.
Perfect. I like that, and that's what I totally agree. And he continues, I do think that a number of your listeners face some of the same general questions, even though my situation may not be representative of an average listener. Perhaps you could, though, address the implications of the loss of the stretch on higher net worth individuals with respect to their tax diversification, and should they prioritize accounts from which to draw from in retirement? When should we forego tax deferral in favor of Roth conversions and taxable accounts? I think what he means is maybe taxable accounts. Or are there any other recommendations you can think of that could improve my tax considerations other than me getting remarried, because I would rather pay taxes than alimony? So a little passive aggressiveness there at the end of his email.
Yeah, he was realizing that, yes, if he was married filing jointly, those tax brackets would be more favorable for him. Unless he married someone that made as much as he did, then he probably wouldn't be helped out much there. But in his current situation, he's in the top tax bracket. There's the one way to move out of that is don't make as much money, which of course is not a practical option for most people, or not one they would prefer. While you do have to pay taxes, if you don't make as much money, it's less money in your pocket as well. So he does have for most people, an enviable tax situation, that he's got income coming in to the extent that pushes him there. But I think with some reasonable projections, he can help. He may not get a crystal clear picture of exactly the steps he should take, but I think he can take he's looking at muddy water right now, and he can clean it up a lot with some reasonable forecasts and projections and kind of a what-if analysis that looks at, in particular, his age 60 and beyond. 60 to 75 is going to be the key to what his whole situation is going to be from a tax perspective. After that, things become more autopilot-ish as you have those forced distributions and you'll kind of settle into a certain level of spending and things like that. But 60 to 75, he's got a lot of flexibility, and that may be enough flexibility where it still makes sense for him to continue to defer, particularly in that cash balance plan, which will allow him to defer a lot of money. That's one of the advantages, you kind of alluded to it, but those are set up where a lot can be shoveled in there because they can be biased towards people that are close to retirement, allowing them to put in a lot more than typical caps on contributions to deferred accounts. But that being said, he's hesitant to do it, but I think he shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Correct. And I want to get into a few elements, too, that I think he needs to be thinking of. And the first thing, and you hit the nail on the head on it, you need some forward-looking tax projections, listener. Your average CPA who's wonderful, and we have nothing against them. They don't have a lot of good forward-looking software. They've got great tax projection software and a lot of brain smarts, but you've got a lot of moving parts here that you have to start looking at. Values of accounts, different rates of return, potential required minimum distributions, coupled with your Social Security is, listener, with the assets you have and the distributions you're going to be taking, your Social Security is always going to be subject to taxes. Mm-hmm. So you have to factor in a lot of these elements. And to have a good way, Chris, to project the benefits of what he's considering doing. If you continue with your cash balance plans on face value, I like that because you're getting money going into, rather, your cash balance plan is giving you $370 back on your income for every $1,000 you're putting in there at the federal level. And in retirement, when you take it out, you might only be at the $240 per $1,000 paying to the government to take it out, or maybe $280. So you're still going to net out more putting it in now than taking it out later. But I also have strategies that you might want to think of besides that. I think you need a tax-focused retirement analysis. You don't need a retirement analysis, listener, to tell you if you can retire. With the assets you have and that you're amassing, and clearly you're an intelligent man with a handle on his finances, you don't strike me as someone who's going to willy-nilly spend everything down recklessly. I don't think, Chris, he needs a retirement plan to tell him he can retire. He needs a retirement plan so we or someone, some other forward-looking advisors who pay attention to taxes, can start projecting from a tax perspective what he's truly looking at. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think, like you said, Chris, his RMDs are going to be that outrageous that he may not be in the highest tax bracket like he is now.
Right.
So that's the first thing I think you need. You need the data. You need to look forward. You need a retirement plan with a tax. We call it in our office a tax-focused retirement analysis. When people work with us, that's what we would say to people in your situation. You don't need a retirement analysis for us to tell you if you can retire. I'm pretty sure we're going to tell you you can retire. So instead of the delivery of the plan focusing on can I retire, the delivery of the plan focuses on tax strategies. So we call it a tax-focused retirement analysis. You need to begin with that. That's the first thing. How can anyone, and I say this all the time, Chris, for more traditional clients listeners who maybe don't have quite the numbers he has, but they're working with quote-unquote financial planners who focus more on assets. And they start telling them, oh, well, you need to invest this way, or you need to buy this thing, usually an annuity, or you need to bring your money over to me and let you invest in my asset under management 1% fee account. And I often tell people, how can anyone tell you what to do with your money until they know what your money needs to do for you? And that's what a plan does. So you need that forward-looking capability to look at your situation. I know the software we use, and every advisor is different, but we use software that actually projects a 1040 tax return now until mortality based on all the variables that we can program in. So we work with our client one-on-one, usually work over the phone, and get all the variables programmed in the way you want to see, and then we run a 1040 now until mortality, and that allows our tax team to start seeing what you're for. If you did nothing, if you continue on the current track you're doing, here's what things look like. Now let's model doing this, doing that, or doing the other thing, and you have the baseline that you can compare it to and start making some projections. So I believe and agree with you, Chris. Planning makes sense. Okay, are we mm-hmm. both on the same page there?
Totally there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I want to throw out a couple of things, mainly one thing that started running through my mind, And he may or may not like this idea, especially with the last sentence that he wrote, that he would rather pay taxes than alimony again. But I kept fixating, Chris, on the fact that he wanted the stretch. He wanted to provide his children a stream of income and provide his children a lump sum inheritance. I got the sense he was looking to do both. He was looking to do it with some trusts. And as I already explained, Chris, his Roth, his life insurance, and his maybe taxable assets, as long as the step-up in basis was still law of the land. And when he put this estate plan together, we probably weren't approaching $26 trillion of national debt. I'm not too convinced there's going to be a step-up in basis. But right now, there is. And that money can easily be put into a trust, I think you'll agree, Chris, income tax-free, be protected for the benefit of his children, and paid out as they need it, whether an income stream for the rest of their life or as a lump sum. Hey, each child has X amount of millions, and they can get at it for these reasons. In other words, he can protect that type of trust till the cows come home from taxes, creditors, and predators. But he viewed his IRA, Chris, as a stretch. So I started thinking, well, wait a minute. There's things you can do here, listener. And one of the things you could do, there's two things you could do. You'll probably like the first rather than the second, but I'm actually attracted to the second, married to the first. So the first thing he can do, Chris, we've already tried to point out to him that his RMDs, relative to all his other assets and the income he's making, which we estimate is over $500,000, his first RMD, assuming his 3.5% average rate of return maintains, is going to be about $160,000. Relatively speaking, far less than he's currently earning. Would you agree?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then living off of his never taxable Roth and manipulating his maybe taxable money, he's going to be in a lot lower bracket in retirement. Agree? Disagree?
So far, I'm on board. Yep.
Okay. Yet he's fixated on a stretch to his kids, and to do that, he wants to stop putting money into the always taxable cash balance plan, which will become an IRA, he said, when he retires, and he rolls it over, and he's given up massive deductions at his top marginal rate. Follow me so far?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want him to give that up, and I want him to have the stretch. I want him to have both. You know where I'm going with this.
I think I do, yes.
What are the initials?
On which part? There's two parts to this.
The second part, the CRT. Those are the initials I'm looking for.
Yes.
What we're saying, what Chris and I is saying, you can tell Chris has no idea. We never talk about these things ahead of time.
And there's other initials to my defense.
And there's other initials because there's two parts to my strategy, right. And Chris is right on that. So what I'm getting at, listener, right now, why don't you have your cake and eat it too? Stop fixating on the fact that you're going to have big RMDs. Yes, if you had no other assets but a $3 million IRA, and you were living on just Social Security and, say, $50,000 of annual income is all you needed, plus Social Security, your $3 million IRA would be a problem because it's going to be generating about $160,000 in RMDs. But you're earning over $500,000 right now. Relative to that, $160,000 RMD isn't too bad. Your brackets are going to be a lot lower in retirement than they are now. So follow my logic with a few things. You could continue to fund and lower your income now at the highest marginal bracket with an account that's always going to be taxable while you are alive and be subject to RMDs at age 72. But allow you for the next 9 years to put $140,000 a year into it, and by his own admission, the last 5 years even more, because these are structured based on your age and proximity to retirement, and shield it, Chris, at the highest marginal bracket.
Right.
Then, in retirement, what you're going to do, you're going to create a charitable remainder trust. I'm not going to get too deep into these because I already spoke to Pete. He is going to come on the podcast and take this discussion a little bit deeper on CRTs. Well, he's going to do it over the phone because he don't want to come in the office because he don't want to get corona. But anyways, what you're going to do with a CRT, it stands for Charitable Remainder Trust, listener. You're going to create another. You already have trusts, so you're familiar with trusts. Charitable Remainder Trust will receive your IRA 100% tax-free at your death.
Right.
And the IRA will pay into the CRT 100% tax-free. The CRT is never taxed because it's a charitable trust. It can rebalance. It can do a lot of different things inside the CRT. And it's not going to have to worry about taxation. However, I bite my tongue on that. We'll have to bring Pete on because depending on how the income is passed out of the CRT, there could be some tax implications. So it's not quite as easy once the money pays in. But it will leave the IRA and enter the trust income tax free. That's the key I want you to walk away from. Now, let's just say there's $3 million. There's $3 million in the CRT. Assuming, and we need Pete here. Pete is the estate planning attorney that I really, really admire. Assuming Pete is here, he can explain the nuances. But in essence, the trust needs to be set up in the day it's funded that at the death of the children beneficiaries, actuarially set up with return expectations that are set by the IRS and that they're at very favorable rates as interest rates go down. The return expectations based on the very low interest rates that the IRS makes you factor, that the trust will have 10% of what you originally put in left over at the death of the beneficiaries if the beneficiaries live to life expectancy. That's how it has to be set up in year one. It doesn't have to maintain that. It has to be set up for that in year one.
And that's so what qualifies it as the charitable remainder trust.
Correct.
Some of it has to go. They're defining how much actually has to be projected to go, not even actually go, but projected to go to the charity ultimately, and that's where they're defining that rule.
Exactly. So follow it. You put $3 million in. There's going to be software we use. We use Number Cruncher from Steve Lineberg's service, but you're going to look at this software, and it's going to tell you how much and how to fund the CRT, rather, and how much can start going to your children every year. And you're going to set the CRT up as a CRUT or a CRAT. Charitable Remainder Annuity Trust, CRAT, or Charitable Remainder Uni Trust. We'll have Pete explain the differences, but in essence, the Uni Trust pays a flat percentage to your children of the trust assets every year. So as they rise, their payments rise. If the trust drops, the payments drop. The Annuity Trust pays the same dollar amount every year, flat out. So a CRAT or a CRUT, you're going to set it up. Most will do CRUTs. But you could do either. If your children, or any beneficiary, not your children, as Pete would say, are about 40 years old or older at your death, this strategy works. If the children are younger than 40, it doesn't work as good. And I'll let Pete explain a lot of the nuances around this. So let's just assume you're 51. Let's assume you did live another 20, 30 years. You already said your children are, I think, in their 20s or whatever. I have a feeling the kids will be over 40 and this should work. Right. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. It doesn't work as well if they're not around age 40, as Pete said. But what that does is it locks in the stretch, Chris. because the trust generally pays out under a CRUT model 5% of the principal of the trust, of the value of the trust every year, to the children. And that kind of locks in what he wanted. He wanted to lock in the stretch. He still has all the other assets paying out to a regular trust, if you will, his life insurance, his Roth, and his maybe taxable assets are in a trust that will allow the children to get the money out in a lump sum and do things with if you have the appropriate language in that trust. But the CRUT, or the CRAT, the CRT, it is doling out your IRA to your children. Now, there's certain ordering rules on the income as it's being sent out. What gets distributed first? Is it going to be the income inside the trust will pass to your kids the way it was earned. So the money coming from your IRA is always going to be taxed to your kids as income because that's what it is. But money that represents gain that the trust has achieved, Chris, over the years would be passed to the kids as capital gain or interest. But there are certain ordering rules on what income comes out of the CRT first. I don't want to start going down that rabbit hole, but it gets passed to the kids about 5% per year and taxed at your children's income tax rate. And Chris, that's what he said he wanted, remember?
Mm-hmm. That was part of the original setup before they kind of pulled the rug out from under him by killing the stretch.
Exactly. That's what he was looking to do. And that is what that trust, the CRT, is going to allow you to do. Now, at your, you're already dead. I was going to say at your death. At the death of the final beneficiary, so whether you do a CRT for one child or two or three, I don't know how many kids he has. At the death of the beneficiaries of their CRT, at the death of the kids, when the if you have two kids and they each have their own CRTs, and I sometimes would recommend that, and I'll explain in a second why. At their death, the remaining money inside that CRT has to go to a charity. Now, you have to be charitably inclined, but here, listener, is where things can get really interesting. Because the IRS, while you are living, listener, and breathing, and the IRA is yours, you cannot take and do a QCD, qualified charitable distribution, which allows you after the age of 70 and a half to take $100,000 a year out of your IRA, even if it was your RMD. And I already told you, you're going to have about $160,000 RMD based on your calculations. You could take $100,000 of that $160,000 and give it to a charity and pay no taxes, never even have to declare it as income. You'd only have to declare $60,000 as income, not $160,000. You could give $100,000 to charity. You cannot give it to a donor advised fund. A donor advised fund is a special fund that you could set up as an individual, put money in it, and start giving it away to charity whenever you want. And you can set it up as an endowment very easily. And at your death, your children take over the trust and they can start donating money. And your children's children and your children's children's children. And it can be this endowment trust, essentially, this endowment fund that you set up that can allow people in your family to donate a certain amount to charity every year. And this trust, let's say your name is Peter Smith, it could be the Peter Smith Family Foundation. And it's all set up through a donor advised fund. Well, you can't put money from your IRA into a donor advised fund through a QCD while you're living. But guess what happens, Chris, at your death?
That's goes away, and ultimately out of the CRT, that's where that leftover money could go and still be somewhat under the control of your family as this charitable endowment that could be directed through further generations. So
absolutely, because what you can then do, listener, is at your death, you can actually set this up. And this is where you're going to need a really good attorney and pay attention to the beneficiary designation forms in your IRA. But you could set it up because you can do, when you inherit an IRA, you don't have to accept the inheritance, do you, Chris? You can do, what can you do to for the first 9 months?
You can disclaim.
Disclaim, exactly. So you name a trust as beneficiary of your IRA, but that trustee has the ability to disclaim to the contingent beneficiary, which just happens to be the primary beneficiary or the contingent beneficiary. You can disclaim into, some can be disclaimed into the CRT, some might be disclaimed into the donor advised fund. And when your beneficiaries pass away, the remaining money in your CRT, yes, has to go to charity. But what if it goes to your family foundation charity that is now allowing your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to continue the, what did I say his name was? Joe Smith? Well, we usually call him George. George Smith? I was making up Joe Smith. Let's say it's George Smith, the George Smith Family Foundation. You can put that money from the CRT all into the family foundation. How is that going to help your grandkids? It gets your grandkids involved right away with gifting and your great-grandkids. You can specify the charities that they gift to. You can specify how much and what percent, rather in percentage terms, of this donor advised fund can be given to charity every year. And if your children want to tithe to churches or give to charitable schools or whatever they want to give to, they can give that money through the donor advised fund and not necessarily have to tie through their own cash flow. If they want to give 10% to a charity every year, to their church rather, it doesn't have to come from their cash flow. It could come, if you allow it, from this family foundation based on their earnings, allowing them to use their money to take care of your family, themselves. I'm just trying to give him ideas, Chris, of how this can work at a 32,000 foot level. You know, we're really high up. We're not drilling down into the nitty gritty. But you could replicate your stretch and tie it into a CRT that ultimately goes to a family foundation donor advised fund. You don't need a true family foundation. Donor advised funds are going to be much cheaper for you to set up and for your family to maintain, which will accomplish much of what you're trying to do. So I started thinking that that is something he should be thinking of. You should also look at that whole life policy. And if it is not, you never once alluded to that whole life policy being in an ILIT, Irrevocable Life Insurance Trust. But if you put that inside an ILIT after 3 years, assuming you die after 3 years of putting it in, that whole death benefit of $1 million is not going to be subject to estate taxes. You have to remember there's two types of taxes here. You're only fixated, listener, on one, income taxes. You're missing the boat on estate taxes. And right now, you aren't that far away from being subject to estate taxes. And I worry at the amount of assets you're going to have and how you don't want to remarry and how politicians are going to, like Chris said, it's going to be very easy for them to raise your taxes without raising your taxes. If they simply say, right now the estate tax exemption for a single person is 11 million something, I forget what it is. But it goes back to 5 million and change, almost 6 million, in another 5 years. He's already above that, Chris.
Right.
You're overlooking estate taxes and where it's going to be in 5 years. And I think the estate tax will be cut even more by future politicians because you've got the money and they need it, listener. They don't give a damn about your kids. They're going to take it from you when you die. He's missing the boat on estate taxes, Chris. The CRT will help with the income taxes. Will also help, I believe, and I wish I was 100% certain on this. We're going to have to ask Chris. I believe the money that goes into the CRT is also exempt from estate taxes. I think. I could be wrong on that. Don't hold me on that. It might be subject to estate taxes. I'm not 100% certain on that one. But an ILIT, the Irrevocable Life Insurance Trust, will own your life insurance policy. You already told me you got a trust set up to be beneficiary of your life insurance. So you could have an ILIT own the life insurance policy. The beneficiary of the ILIT is the trust that you have set up for the ILIT.
Right, and the proceeds still go where you want it to go. It's just a matter of that's a technique to separate that $1 million worth of death benefit from your estate.
Your taxable estate.
So most people don't have to worry about that at the current limits, but you're already at the cusp of needing to worry about it. And I agree with Jim. They cut these estate limits back. You're definitely going to have to worry about that. So that's a fairly simple way to remove in one big chunk some portion that would normally be part of your taxable estate by getting it out into the ILIT.
Exactly. So I would work and look at that. I would look at the CRT, married to a donor-advised fund.
He said he didn't want to get married.
Well, yeah, he doesn't want to get married. Right. Unless you are very charitably inclined and you want to leave money to your alma mater, to your church, or to a national charity, and you don't want to deal with the donor advised fund. But a lot of people, Chris, overlook the benefit of that donor advised fund and setting it up as a foundation, an endowment rather, and allowing their children and their children are probably dead because they were the beneficiaries of the CRT, but their grandchildren and great-grandchildren to continue the family legacy. But it also helps those family members if the family members are gifting through the donor advised fund or endowment set up through it. It allows some of their money to go through because they still want to benefit their family, but they also want to benefit maybe their church. Well, here's how you can do it. You see what I'm trying to explain there?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you could have that ability, and that money in the donor advised fund set up as an endowment stays there for future generations as long as you want before it finally pays out ultimately to a charity of your choosing, or you can let some future person who never even met you but gets to look at your velvet picture above the fireplace all the time of the person who set this all up, and eventually you can let this thing end and say, okay, this is what my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather did, and I'm going to now pass the money out. But you can set it up that way to do it, or you can just leave it to charity right off the bat. But it's really weird how you cannot give to a donor advised fund through a QCD while you're alive, but at your death, you can name a donor advised fund as beneficiary of your IRA or pay a charitable remainder trust to a donor advised fund. That just doesn't seem to make sense, does it?
I mean, to me, it doesn't. It seems a little strange to me, too.
But that's the way the rules are written. So I wanted him to look at all of that. Anyways, I did allude to that there was a other thing that I really like that he may not, but I think he should at least analyze it. And that would be, in conjunction with your ex, to start looking. You've got millions, listener, and I don't know how much of your RMDs, your future RMDs, you're going to need. But you're fixated on trying to pay these conversion taxes at your higher rate, or stop saving, Chris, and get a deduction now at his higher rate and start paying that money in taxes instead to be able to leave his children a tax-advantaged inheritance with a hoped-for step-up in basis, or a tax-free inheritance with his Roth assets. Why not, with your spouse,
ex-spouse,
excuse me, don't kill me there, listener, take out a second-to-die guaranteed universal life policy. That can be set up with you and your wife. You have to have insurable interest with your beneficiaries. Your beneficiaries are going to be your kids. There is insurable interest there. You guys are both parents. If you don't have to be married to the person to buy a second-to-die guaranteed universal life policy. You both have to have an insurable interest with the beneficiaries. She doesn't even have to pay the premiums. You just need her to go through underwriting. She didn't have to do anything else anymore. But if both your lives were on this policy, you see where I'm going with this, Chris. He's 51.
And I'm also picturing in my mind how this conversation is going to go.
Well, he can breach that with her later. But what I'm getting at, listener, you could, rather than paying all this money in taxes to try to leverage it into a tax-free inheritance, why not spread it out and start taking $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year of distributions from these accounts, which, again, it's going to start throwing off $160,000 in your 70s. You're only 51. You know how dirt cheap a SGUL, a survivorship guaranteed universal life policy, would relatively be for someone his age, assuming him and his wife are reasonably healthy? You might, with just $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, listener, leverage that into $3, $4, $5, $6 million of guaranteed inheritance at the death of the second one of you. I agree there. But now you could then take, Chris, your entire IRA, or maybe not all of the IRA. You could put some in a CRT and leave some to a charity right away, or give some to a grandchild, or do other things with it. He's overlooking the leverage that life insurance can give him. He's not adverse to life insurance. He bought $1 million whole life policy at 39. Mm-hmm. Now, by leveraging two lives, we've talked about this, listener, repeatedly, two lives bring the cost of permanent life insurance down really low. So you buy it on you and your wife. You set it up where you pay the premiums. You'll be able to afford them. Your ex doesn't have to get anything out of this. She won't. It just pays off to your kids at the death of the second person, which most likely would be your ex. So you would want to set this up with a trust that would absolutely guarantee and continue the premium payments on this SGUL policy. And it would probably own the policy. So your wife can't change it or do anything. And it just is using the benefit of her life and your life to leverage even more inheritance. Mm-hmm. So your children's inheritance, Chris, comes in stages. There's some at his death, and then maybe 7, 8, 10, 12 years later, more at the second death.
Yep. With some nice, clean tax consequences on the second. Yep.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And set up properly, the life insurance is inherited income and estate tax-free. And that's what I'm trying to fixate on. Now, I don't know if someday life insurance will be subject to taxation, income taxation. It's already subject to estate taxation. But will it be subject to income taxation? I don't know. The insurance lobby is very powerful. But if this country were to get into enough debt, I could see that happening, Chris. However, I would see it being run this way. Every insurance policy purchased after the passage of this law will be subject to income taxes when inherited. Every existing insurance policy will not be. You see this constantly, Chris. They grandfather in.
Right.
So if this is set up, and don't rush into this, you don't have to set this up this year. But I'm telling you, this is just something else I started thinking of that he needs to look at. There still may be a lot of animosity with his ex, and he doesn't want to bring this up yet. But both you and your wife could bury the hatchet, ex-wife, can bury the hatchet long enough for the benefit of your children, who I'm sure you both equally love dearly. Clearly you do, because you're looking to benefit them, and I am certain their mother does as well. Put your differences aside. I don't know what caused the divorce. It doesn't matter. This is all for the kids. You guys don't even have to go through underwriting together. You just need to look at this and say, wait a minute. I've got a lot of free cash flow. I'm going to have required distributions. I'm trying to optimize a stretch out and low taxes. And they're overlooking, Chris, the best asset for doing that, life insurance. Right. The Secure Act is really given a rebirth to life insurance, especially most people who start doing this already in their 70s, where the leverage isn't as good. I'm guessing if he's 51, his wife has got to be, somewhere in her 50s or 40s. Still, from a life insurance perspective, Chris, very young. Mm-hmm. And they can get really good leverage on millions at premiums that, relative to the assets he's talking, could be 1% of his assets a year, if not less, to leverage into millions of tax-free estate and tax-free income inheritance, protected fully in a trust, spreading out over his death and later his wife's death, ex-wife rather, tremendous benefit. And it can be set up where she's just lending her life onto the policy, but she doesn't receive anything. It can be set up. It's not being mean to her. That's how SGULs are set up. They pay at the death of the second spouse to benefit children. But there's no law that says you got to be married. You have to have an insurable interest. So you can't find some stranger on the street and say, hey, put your life on my life insurance policy. I want to lower my premiums. Well, there's definitely insurable interest between parents. Mm-hmm. So I just started thinking of that too. I'll end there. But I thought that was something else he needs to consider. Any thoughts and feedback before we wrap up?
No, those are two good, though somewhat complicated approaches. The second one is actually more straightforward from a paperwork standpoint, but more complicated relationship-wise. The first one is a little more complicated as far as engaging an attorney and setting up the CRT and all these kind of moving parts. That's more complex, but don't involve the ex in that, so it's probably emotionally less traumatic. But yeah, those are definitely things to consider looking at his goals. I think his goals are aligned with possibly one or both of those possibilities that you mentioned there. So things
exactly.
We've talked about a little bit in the past, I think we do need to get Pete on. He can shed some light on some of the specifics. And in particular, if you're intrigued by these and have a question for Pete, shoot those over to us quickly. I don't know when Pete's going to be on, but hopefully it's not in the too distant future. And any specific questions you all might have as listeners, if you get them to us before Pete's on the show, I'll make sure Pete gets those answered for you. So
absolutely. So anyways, we do. I know this podcast ran long, but as I started contemplating, this is why I wanted to turn it into an EDU show, because I was like, oh, my God, I can run with this. And this is the planning strategies that people need to be thinking of. And hopefully, for a man with the amount of assets he has, if he's working with professionals, they've breached these topics with him. But I don't know. But the first thing that popped into my mind is, why are you even thinking conversions? You want to leave a tax-free inheritance, life insurance. You've got an ex. You've got a mother of your kids. My God. Take all that money you were going to pay in taxes on conversions and leverage it into premiums in an SGUL. Assuming your health is there, you can lock in millions, estate and income tax free. Yep. That's what appealed to me, because he's not far away from estate taxation. Yep. And I have a feeling estate tax limits are going to go down, and he might be subject to not only income taxes. Could you imagine if everything he's trying to do, Chris, and then his assets that he thought would get a step up in basis don't? And they're still going to be subject to estate taxes. Keep that in mind. The step up in basis just wipes out the embedded cap gain. The entire account balance, which already is $10 million, is what he's figuring at age 60, Chris. That goes into his estate.
Right.
That doesn't get any protection from estate taxes. And in 9 years, when you're 60, listener, the estate tax limit is supposed to be less than $6 million by then. What if they cut it back to 3 or 1? You're fixating on income taxes and you're ignoring estate taxes. An islet, a CRT, an SGUL, and the magic of life insurance. That's how you can leave millions income and estate tax free. And here's the kicker, Chris. All guaranteed.
Right.
100% guaranteed. But you're already with New York Life, for Pete's sakes, listener. New York Life isn't going anywhere. No, I'm not saying they're not going to have a SGUL, I don't think. I think they're big on the whole life, not so much on the universal life side. But I could be wrong in that. I'm not a whole a New York Life agent. But what I'm saying is he's already comfortable with the concept of highly rated carriers and the guarantees of life insurance. He's not fixated enough on estate taxes. He's ignoring it. He's fixated on income. And the 900 or 800 pound orangutan in the, not orangutan, what is it? The other monkey there.
Gorilla.
Gorilla. Yeah. The 900 pound gorilla. Is it elephant or gorilla? Whatever.
It's a gorilla.
Is it a gorilla? Yeah. How did I come up with orangutan?
I don't know. There's also the elephant in the room, but we usually talk about the 800 pound gorilla.
800 pound gorilla.
For some reason,
orangutans are pretty big.
For some reason, when you name a weight, it's attached to a gorilla, but then if an elephant, it's just an elephant. It's not a weighted element. I don't know.
Yeah, but in Every Which Way But Loose, Clyde was an orangutan, and he had that
awesome. He was 800 pounds, though.
He went in, well, he was still pretty big. Remember, he had that awesome right turn, Clyde, and he'd punch people and knock them out.
Got it, yeah.
But, anyways. What I'm saying is you're missing the orangutan, gorilla, or elephant in the room, which is estate taxes. And life insurance will help you with that. With an islet, irrevocable life insurance trust, the CRT will easily handle the stretch out you want and receive your money tax-free and marry it to a donor-advised fund. You can help future generations. Boom. Solved. And to hell with these little pittance conversions. Keep getting your income tax deduction, putting money in your cash balance pension plan up front. Yep. There.
So I'm going to cut Jim off now since we can all go on to bigger and better things after hour and 48 minutes.
This one was a passionate one. I like this one. So, I'll let you go. Thanks, listeners, for tolerating me. I really enjoyed this one. I thought this case was unique. This guy has a lot of opportunities. He wanted some ideas. Hopefully he got more ideas than he knows what to do with.
Probably.
Talk to you later, Chris.
Talk to you later. So, everybody, thanks for sticking with us. We'll have another show, obviously, next week. If you've got an idea, like this listener had, for a lengthy EDU show, maybe not this lengthy. This went a little excessively long. Thanks for sticking with us, if you can still hear my voice. I haven't given up at this point. But not all shows are quite this long, but this one is pretty complex, has a lot of moving parts and a lot of things to talk about. So, please send us an email or on a contact form is probably better because then both Jim and I get a copy of it. If you go to our website, jimhelps.com, you can learn a little bit more about us, what we do, and also submit a topic for the EDU show or even a question for our Q&A show that a lot of you who listen to the EDU shows also listen to the Q&A shows. So if you have a shorter non-EDU show length question you want to just handle on the Q&A show, you can send us that question through that same contact form. So thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.